kind of pulled me into it somewhat some years ago.
I do.
And when I looked at the background material,
self-appointed position. I just got interested in protecting the Blythe estuary in 2005 when the Environment Agency sent round a leaflet saying they were abandoning the estuary. I thought, well, being an engineer, I thought, I'll ask them why. So this is how it all started. So the first slide we have here is a breach that occurred in the 2013 December storm surge. It went over this wall here by about 300 millimetres, and it eroded the back of the wall and then eroded right the way through it. This area here is the saltings, and behind me here is the river, which is attached to the sea. That area flooded there is the marsh, which once was a grazing marsh. The Environment Agency have now filled up this breach, which is very kind of them. They could have left it. And the water has drained away, the grass has regrown, and the cows are now munching on the grass. So it has a positive point of it. So let's have a look at the rest of it. So here's the recent history of sea events, and it first started with the IPCC first and supplementary reports in 1990 to 1992, where it predicted a catastrophic sea level rise and bigger storm surges. At this point, Margaret Thatcher was in charge of the government. She was very, very worried about climate change. So she asked John Gummer to start the Environment Agency, because she thought that it's going to cost the Treasury a lot of money to protect the coast against accelerated sea level rise and increasing storm surges. Before this time, it was the sea defences were the responsibility of the local authority and the National Rivers Authority. So it was taken away from them. Their experienced coastal engineers were retired, and the Environment Agency took over. Now, before they took over, the Environment, the local authorities worked on the basis of need. They prepared the banks and the walls on the basis of need, and a benefit-cost ratio of about 1:1. Now, this is completely unheard of today, because the Environment Agency immediately raised it to 8:1. This almost eliminated the defences in rural areas. They were virtually abandoned, and this is what we're suffering from at the moment. So urban areas are protected, rural areas are realigned and abandoned. 2 years ago, John Gummer, in his Climate Change Committee report, gave the figures of abandonment of the rural defences of England and Wales at 15%, this a realignment by 2050. For Norfolk, this is an extremely high figure of 34% of the existing defences are going to be abandoned by 2030, and in Suffolk it's 27%, very high figure. This then forced rural communities to design and fund their own schemes, and this is where I came in to see how I could help the Blythe Estuary Group get planning permission and design the walls and the wall reinstatement to protect the estuary. This is a plot of the storm surges.
Before you go on, I'd like to, could you step back one?
Yes, of course.
I don't know to what extent this applies to Southeast Suffolk. But in the Fenlands north of Cambridgeshire, a fairly complicated hierarchy of commissioners was set up, who in turn set up a hierarchy of drainage boards, and these were funded by local taxes. I think that still works in that, for instance, farmers will pay tax.
Yes, that's the internal drainage board.
Yes.
Yes, that is still working. But it used to be funded by the government. The internal drainage boards, when the Environment Agency took over, almost stopped all funding to the internal drainage boards. And they shrank.
Yeah.
They're still there, but they have absolutely no funding at all, other than the small amount that they raise from the landowners of land that they drain. But it's a fraction of what they used to have. So they have almost no power whatsoever at the moment. That might change in the future.
Yeah, because it used to operate as a good scheme.
Yeah, it did, absolutely. It was a very good scheme. But the Environment Agency basically took over and stopped all the funding.
Is that what happened to the Somerset
level? Well, it probably did. I don't know very much about it, but it was certainly subjected to the 8-to-1 benefit cost ratio. The Environment Agency, as you probably know, decided that they would start preparing it, and that was on a basis 2-to-1. That's the figure that I heard about 2 or 3 months ago. So they lowered the benefit cost ratio to 2-to-1 in order for them to rebuild the walls. And of course, before the Environment Agency, there were 12 dredgers, or six or 12 dredgers, who dredged the rivers and put the mud back on the top of the walls to raise them and keep them in good order to cope with sea level rise. And of course, that all stopped completely when the Environment Agency took over. They sold off all the dredgers and just waited for the disaster.
Can I just ask something? What's the level of the Fens and the level of the Somerset and the level of your fields? Are they related to one another?
Well, they're all related to the mean high water level. Sorry, the mean
the
sea level.
Are they below sea level, any of the Fens? Or?
Well, it depends how long they've been embanked. In Suffolk and Norfolk, we have about 340 millimetres of mean high water sea level rise per century, which is a considerable amount, the highest in the country, and that is because the land is sinking by 1.5 millimetres a year. We have about 1.3, 1.4 millimetres of sea level rise, and the tidal range is increasing by about 0.6 of a millimetre per year.
But I think the interest of your question was how far down does the Fen go?
Yes.
Well, the one that goes furthest down is to Peterborough on the Fen, where you would be standing with your feet 10 feet below the sea level.
Really?
Yes.
Like Holland.
And there are many other areas where -1 metre, -2 metre, don't have to go from far north of Cambridge.
It's slightly different in the Blythe estuary because all our marshes are marine clay. In the Fens, it's almost 90% to 100% peat. And when you drain peat, it shrinks and it oxidizes, and you can get very significant drop in level. In the Blythe, none of the marshes have changed their height at all. They are absolutely fixed. because there's at least 5 metres of marine clay on top of the wall. There are areas of peat, but it's mainly marine clay. When you go further up the estuary, it then becomes peat, and then that is subjected to the normal shrinkage of peats. But the area that I'm talking about, most of the Blythe estuary is clay. So these figures I extracted from the Lurstock tide gauge, and these figures start in about 1964 here, and the last one I did is in fact 2009. Now, you probably know in 2013 we had a storm surge, which in the Blythe, or just outside the Blythe, it was about 3 metres OD. So we had quite a significant rise there, and for a shorter period of time. Between the surges, you've got 7 years, 7 years, 10 years, and 14 years. We're getting further apart. Now we have one that's only 6 years from the previous one, and it's much higher. Now this could be due to the fact that the planet is cooling, despite what you've heard. It may be going through a cooling phase, as it did in the 40s and 50s when we had the main 53 storm surge, and we might be getting a repeat of that. So I expect to see more frequent storms, not due to warming, but due to cooling, despite what we hear. Now this is a plot of sea level rise. This is from Professor Philip Woodworth of the Proudman Oceanographic Laboratory. He produced this graph of the tide gauges. That's the mean tide gauge level, starting in 1900 and ending up there. I think it gets to about 2005 or 6. Since then, the level has actually come down a bit. And as you can see, you can draw straight lines on that. That's 1.4 millimetres per year. And there is no evidence at all of any sea level rise acceleration. And that hasn't. So there's been none there for 100 years. In my opinion, it's up on the marshes that I've measured in the fly. There's been no acceleration of, or no change of sea level rise from 1.4 millimetres a year for the last 400 years since the start of, since the end of the Little Ice Age, about 1600. And the temperature started rising. So there's no evidence at all of accelerating sea level rise. Now, the Environment Agency, DEFRA, have produced this curve. It's not terribly good. I did quite a rush this morning. So this is DEFRA sea level rise based on UK CP09 medium scenario, medium emission scenario, and the 95th percentile. A bit irrelevant that, but this is the figure which they have asked the Environment Agency to work on. And this figure of sea level rise here goes up to 8 millimetres by the year 2110, something like that. This here is 1.4 millimetres per year, which is the figure from the previous slide showing a fixed level of sea level. Now whether that will in fact increase or decrease, I don't know, but I've just drawn a straight line. But of course we're here at the moment, this is 2015, it's still 1.4, but the Environment Agency and DEFRA and the government are telling us it's 4.5. When I have actually challenged them on this, they've got nothing to do with this particular curve. It's what it will get to in 2100 that you've got to worry about. Well, my view is, if that is the curve that they're saying we have to work from, then why tell us it's 4.5 when it's still only 1.4? It makes no sense.
It's an interesting sort of contradictory logic in what's important. You said they were not interested in that particular curve, but in where it would be in...
Well, they said they weren't interested, that you shouldn't be concerned that it is in fact not 4.5, because because they know it's not 4.5 millimetres a year, but that is the curve which they tell everybody that they must use to do their planning of costings for sea defence. And this is the basis of the abandonment of the coast of Great Britain.
Yeah, it's just that to make a prediction, say, 100 years ahead, you will be stepping along some predictive model.
Yes, I'll come to those at the end. I'll show you how they arrive at this.
What are those centaurs? That's the 95th. There must be a whole spread of centaurs.
Yes, there are.
All the way down. What
Pardon?
What about a straight line? Is that the 20th or 30th or what?
Where the 50th would be somewhere here, really along there, and the 5% line would be somewhere here.
Well, it might be below that horizontal line. That's what's worrying me.
Well, it could be a I've got the figures. I just haven't plotted them on there.
But they chose
That is the one where
they've chosen that to be more safe than sorry. Is what they're saying.
It's yes, exactly.
Over the 95th.
Yes. Right. This is the Blythe Estuary. Here is Southwold. Here is Walswick, where I live. Pam lives somewhere here. The harbour is here, and there are 50 to 100 boats moored in this area. It's a very busy harbour. I don't know if many of you have been there, but it's a really beautiful place. There's what's called the Bailey Bridge, which goes across the river there. The marshes are here. This is Southwold Town Marsh and extends up to here. The whole of that is Southwold Town Marsh. Walberswick Town Marsh is this one here. Then we've got Thinker's Marsh here. That has been abandoned by the Environment Agency already. Raiden Marsh is very, very, because it was embanked probably 500 years ago, it's extremely deep. It's about 1.5 metres lower than the saltings today. These mudflats here are the marshes that were breached in the 50s. This was all green grass in the 50s, so it was this. Here. So there's three marshes there which have been breached around about 1950 or thereabouts. This is the A12 bridge, that's the A12 going up there, and these are marshes which stretch up about 4 kilometres. There's marshes either side of those, and upstream of Bailey Bridge is a tidal prism which is 25% of the tidal prism of this part of the estuary.
Can you say what the tidal prism
is? I will tell you now what a tidal prism is. It is the volume of water that flows into the estuary between mean high water springs and mean low water springs. And for this estuary it's about 2.5 million cubic metres.
But in that it goes in and out.
In and out, yes. It goes in and out. Because some rivers you might have a high flow coming down the river from here, and that would affect the mean somewhat. So really one should talk about the flow in to the estuary rather than the flow out.
The photograph you showed at the beginning, was that the town marshes?
That was Walberswick Town Marsh. Or that's also known as Robinson's Marsh, which is this one here. And the breach was about here, and that was looking sort of southwest through the breach. So this is the Environment Agency's Blythe Estuary strategy, and this is really purely down to the fact that they raised the benefit cost ratio to 8-1, and so none of the banks are sustainable according to them. So they're going to be abandoned. So that's all the defences upstream of the A12 were abandoned in 2009. Thinker's Marsh already abandoned in 2007. The Henry Beds and Raiden Marsh, these are both Natura sites which should be protected, They're going to be abandoned in 4 years' time. Southall Town Marsh and Warbeswick Town Marsh will be abandoned in 2029. So, let's just deal with the Natura sites. There's rather a lot of words up there, but basically the Blythe actually has two Natura sites, Tinkers Marsh and Hen Rebates. Both are designated under the EU Birds and Habitats Directive as special protection areas, SPAs. They are required to be protected under EU and international law. Neither site breaches the EA's 8-to-1 benefit cost ratio target. Site protection can only be withdrawn where a site is required for a specific overriding natural purpose, the harbour, a motorway or reservoir. And as we can see, the two Natura sites are to be abandoned. Now in my view, this is illegal, but somehow they've got away with it. I have written to the EU Commissioner about it, and they said, oh, you must take it up with the Environment Agency, don't talk to us. So I didn't get any joy there. So, replacement habitat must be provided in the same estuary and brought to a similar conservation standard before de-designation is permitted. Tinkers Marsh was abandoned in 2007 on the grounds of cost following the storm surge. Now this was written in a letter to the landowner, but of course you can't tell the EU commissioners that you've abandoned a Natura site on the grounds of cost. It's not legal. So they had to come up with some other scheme, and that is something which I'll deal with later when they claim that the defences are unsustainable. Because they can't say, we've got a benefit cost ratio of 8-to-1, and so we're abandoning a Natura site. That would be unlawful. So they've had to use another ploy, which I'll talk about in a moment. So, however, the EU's IROPI, which is the imperative reason of overriding public interest, which is the only way you could abandon a Natura site, it does not mention cost, as this is not a legitimate imperative reason. The hen reed beds will be abandoned in 2019. Replacement habitat for both sites was purchased in Snape by the Environment Agency in 2007. Last year the Snape site was flooded by a storm surge. That's the 2013 storm. And these sites are supposed to last 100 years. And yet it was flooded. Only last year.
It's not even in the same estuary either.
It's not in the same estuary, exactly. So they can just make it up as they go along. I expect they would say to the EU, well, we can't find a place in the Blythe, we've had to put it in the nearest one we can. And they're spending £5 million doing that.
When it comes to, as it were, getting out marshals and moving them elsewhere, as this sort of thing. There is a feature, for instance, one particular marsh will have a certain ecological characteristic and will therefore preferably attract a certain species of wildlife. Another one would have a different ecological characteristic, attract different species of wildlife. Now when you start shuffling these around, what do they do?
Well, you put a big sign up to the birds, say, go to Snape, it's this way, 10 miles down there. And the birds are very clever, and they flap their wings and they end up there.
Yeah.
Hopefully, if it's not full of water. I don't know, it's, who knows, but they have to do it so they believe on the legal basis that if they're abandoning two sites, which they shouldn't because they should be for a national purpose, but they're abandoning it because they say the walls are unsustainable. So they have to create habitat elsewhere. That money, the money that they've spent doing that, £5 million, could have rebuilt the entire estuary three times over.
That's what they're pushing up to Vinsley.
Yes, along might go to Vinsley.
It's
one of the largest sites for avocets, in fact, Tinkers Marsh. And There's, what do they call it? Booming birds. What are they? Bitterns. there's a lot of bitterns in the hen reed beds. Whether they'll find their way there, I don't know.
But each marsh has a different species nesting in it.
Yeah.
All the way around.
You'll see later that there's absolutely nothing wrong with these walls. They could be maintained for the next 100 years. There's nothing wrong with them at all. But it's the dogma and the policy that the Environment Agency and Natural England are having to pursue. Because that's what they're paid to do. They're paid to deliver the government's policy, right or wrong. Right, that's a photograph I took of Tinker's Marsh storm surge in 2007, just about to breach the Tinker's Marsh wall.
Which side is the sea?
This is the river, just checking. The sea. This is the marsh, which is slowly filling up with water. And you can see it's eroding from the inside as it goes over the top. And you can see a line there about 300 millimetres above that. So you can see that the water was in fact very much higher, probably about 3 or 4 hours before. And it's now fallen. So that site, that breach was about here. So the scientific basis for the strategy. Black and Veatch are the Environment Agency's consultants, and they told us that the estuary walls were unsustainable due to sediment loss from the mudflats and a predicted 64% increase in both river flow and tidal prism by 2100. I put here, if this were true, the defences would indeed be unsustainable. That is a description of the tidal prism which I've already dealt with. So I thought, well, let's ask them some questions. So Black and Veatch stated the mudflat sedimentation loss was contrary, or stated, Black and Veatch's stated mudflat sediment loss was contrary to our own observations. There was mud everywhere. Everybody could see it. It's as high as an elephant's eye. And they said, no, you are losing sediment. So we knew it was wrong, but we had to prove it. Black and Veatch then referred us to papers and reports written by their consultant, Blythe Estuary Modeller, Dr. John French of UCL. I read his papers, and Dr. French's conclusions were not based on any actual mudflat measurements, but on the calculated differences between the marsh and mudflat elevations of today and the relative marsh elevations from an 1840 survey. We never actually checked anything. He just said, oh, I've done all these calculations, the estuary was losing sediment. And one of the ways I proved it wrong was something I got there, which is which you might like to have a look at after the talk, which I worked out how he made this error. I think whether he did it on purpose, I don't know. It was a very serious scientific error. So I didn't believe it. So I built 10 sampling tubes to check and found 500 millimetres of mud laying on the old marsh surfaces reached in the 50s. A very healthy sedimentation rate of about 10 millimetres a year. Now, with sea level rise of 3.4 millimetres per year, this marsh is accreting, and if left to its own devices, within 100 or 150 years, the whole all the mudflats in the estuary would be turned into salt marsh and be vegetated. But of course they didn't say that. They said you're losing sediment and your tidal prism is going to increase, and it's going to wash your banks into the North Sea. I didn't believe it, and we eventually got Professor Kenneth Pye conducted a more thorough survey. He took 170 samples all over the mudflats and found an average sedimentation rate to be 9.7 millimetres per year, very close to the figures that I found with my 10 sampling tubes. But this completely refuted Black and Veatch's model and the Environment Agency's belief that the estuary walls were unsustainable. However, this is one of my sampling tubes, and this is a guy I got to walk on the marshes, so I wanted to do it myself because he looked a bit dangerous to me. But he's an oyster catcher, he has oyster pots or whatever it is around the estuary, and he's, oh, I'll walk on that. But he took me out of his boat, and I got him to use this sampling tube. So we took 10 samples with tubes like that all over the estuary, and that's where we found, instead of no sediment, we found 500 millimetres of sediment.
It's very clever that, Richard. I think you haven't explained the amethyst.
Yes, well, there's a slot, that's a steel bar, which you could then
hammer up and down. Otherwise you get stuck. You can't get it down.
You take it down through the soft mud until you reach the hard old salt marsh, or the old marsh underneath. Then you can't get it through that because it's really very, very solid. So there's plenty of sedimentation in the Glyde. And in fact, in other estuaries in Suffolk, also 10 millimetres has been found, 9 millimetres here, 10 millimetres somewhere else. So the whole of the coast of East Anglia is quite capable of maintaining the tidal prism in the face of 3.4 millimetres of sea level rise and even probably 10 millimetres. So we don't need to worry about the tidal prism increasing in our estuaries in Suffolk or probably Norfolk as well, because there's plenty of sediment coming into the sea, being deposited in the marshes, being able to keep the tidal prism in equilibrium. So the Environment Agency's response to our refutation. Now, the first bit is not—it's not their response. It's a sort of statement of the facts. 9.7 millimeters per year of mudflat sedimentation. The prism and river flow would fall by 20% by 2100 with the expected sea level rise. So, even with a high accelerated sea level rise, the tidal prism would still fall. So all the walls in the estuary are in fact sustainable, even right up to 2100. The EA eventually conceded that the prism could fall. As it could fall, they wouldn't accept that it would, but stated they would not be changing their strategy, as in their opinion, the walls would collapse if raised. Now they brought this completely out of the blue. They came to a meeting in my house, actually. They all sat round the table. I said, look, we can now all work together to protect the walls in the estuary. And they said, sorry, we don't agree with you. We still believe the walls are unsustainable, so the strategy still stands. We're still going to give you abandonment. We pointed out that the walls had been raised by half a metre a century for the last 400 years, and none had collapsed. Of course they ignored that. This was met with, you have your opinion, we have ours, and we are never going to agree. That's what they actually told me. Mm-hmm. So they're not supposed to do that. They're supposed to have answers to these things and give evidence. But it wasn't about evidence, it was about delivering the policy of the government. That's what they're paid to do, and that's what they did. What we did not know at the time was that a year before they had already purchased replacement habitat at Snake and were spending £5 million on habitat recreation. So they had already decided a year before it was unsustainable, bought the habitat, and they just couldn't go back on it, I suppose. They would have looked probably very silly by their bosses if they suddenly said, oh, those people in the Glyde estuary, they've actually got a very good point here. We can repair all the walls after all. Not something they were going to do. Despite much lobbying, the Wayne District Council approved the EA strategy in 2009. Now, we tried to tell our own council that they got the science wrong, but this had no effect at all, because councils, as you probably realise, the last thing they can be seen to do is arguing with the government. If government pay them all sorts of monies, and if they said no, the science is wrong, and made a stand, they'd be the only one of 23 district councils that had approved the strategies all the way around the coast of Great Britain. They would never have got away with it.
And of course, for a council, if it gets technical, it has to go out to a consultancy. And you may not argue with
that. Exactly. Well, we tried. We had to try. I wrote to every single councillor pointing out where it was wrong, but of course it made no difference. It was just all agreed, and that's what we've got.
Is it true, I mean, in the same sense, that if you go out to a consultancy and you're paying them to do the work, they want more work in the future, so they will tell you what you want to hear, or is this some black propaganda? Because that's what seems to happen. You want to keep, even if you're in a university, an academic, and all the rest of it, still you want to keep the department going. You've got to wash your own face. All academic departments. This is, if so, it's a big scandal.
The interesting.
Am I wrong?
Sorry.
I don't think you are.
The interesting thing is that we were told that all the science for the strategy was peer-reviewed. So I asked them for their list of peer reviewers.
Yes,
one of them was Dr. John French, who made a mistake on the sedimentation. The other one was Royal Haskany, who were the environment agency's consultants in other places. The other one was a member of Natural England, which is part of the government, and the other one was a member of the environment agency's own staff. There's not a single person who was independent in that review.
I mean, Dr. French did take samples, but only of the grass at the edge of the mud.
He measured one of the
roots on, did he?
Yeah. I actually phoned up Dr. French and said, why didn't you take some measurements from the middle of the mud flats? It's all far too dangerous.
There you are with a oyster catcher out there doing it.
Fantastic, wasn't it? And he said it was too dangerous for him to go out on there. He, the older person, had to do it himself.
Well, luckily, I actually found two people who were prepared to do it. So, I mean, I had to sit in the boat and give them instructions, of course. Right, plan for the future. So we are going to do something about the wharves in the estuary. We must protect the estuary in Southport Harbour from an increasing tidal pressure. We need to raise and strengthen the wharves. In 2009 we obtained planning permission to raise and reinstate 8 kilometres of wharve to a height that would give us protection from our normal 1 in 20 storm surges. We had excellent support from the Environment Agency, Natural England and District Council. They were very good, despite, because they didn't care. As long as the policy was still unchallenged and still in operation, they would give us all the help you need. Yes, of course you can raise all the banks.
Within the abandonment policy.
But we can't tell you they're sustainable. Of course, we think they're unsustainable, but if you're silly enough to try and raise them yourself, of course you can. We'll help you and we'll give you all the assistance you want. And they did. They were very helpful. I did the planning application myself. I've not done one before. And with the help of these people, it was quite a straightforward thing. It took about 3 months. Right. Is that... yes. So, our wall reinstatement plan was expected to be self-financing through the use of waste soil from the construction industry. Our plan was to put an access track behind the wall, and this would require several thousand truckloads of waste soil, which would be behind the wall, and we would get like £60 a truckload from the people who are bringing in the trucks as for the deposition charges to deposit the waste soil. And that money we would use to pay diggers to rebuild the walls. Sadly, the construction industry sort of went into a bit of a decline at this time, and the project was put on hold. But one of the landowners did some work. Limited work was begun on Tinker's Marsh Wall in 2011, funded by the landowner. So the planning application is extant. That means that we can carry on maintaining the wall at our leisure at any time in the future. Next year we'll start on the north walls on the project. Right, now you might say, well, what has made the Environment Agency, DEFRA and the government take this action? Well, it all stems from the IPCC predictions of catastrophic sea level rise and increasing storm surges. The IPCC, that's the International Panel on Climate Change, was set up in 1988 in three working groups. Working group one was assigned to detect climate change and attribute the change to human CO2 emissions. Group two was to assess the impact of climate change. Group three, formulate action to mitigate the effects of climate change. Now, obviously, the work of groups two and three were to be based on the output of group one, because you can't work on the impact of climate change and formulate action to mitigate it unless you have proof that CO2 emissions are causing the problem. But all three groups were set to work immediately because of perceived emergency. So they were, one was really forcing the other, and that I think is the basis of the problem that we have with the IPCC and the evidence that they have produced so far. They were working on this factor here, doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from 280 parts per million, which is the pre-industrial level, to 560 parts per million, expected around 2000. It's believed to increase the global temperature by 1 degree. The effect is logarithmic. Currently CO2 is 400 parts per million, so we have about 26% or 0.26 of a degree to go. Now that isn't very much. And you think, well, what is the problem with that? Well, what the clever people, the IPC, have done, has said, well, if the temperature warms, then there will be more water vapour in the atmosphere, and this will have a multiplying effect on the effect on this 2.6 degrees. It will multiply it by a factor of 6 or more. And that's how they get the climate sensitivity. The 90 climate models that have been produced so far were built on the assumption that the climate sensitivity lay between 2 degrees and 4.5 degrees for doubling of CO2. That is from now. The increase over 2.6 is based on water vapour feedback. I don't think there is any, because I think what they haven't done, a lot of people pointed this out, is that the climate models are unable to model cloud albedo, that is, the reflection of clouds. Obviously, if you have higher temperature, more water vapour, then you get more clouds and there's more reflection of the sunlight. And the models can't do it because they can't model it, because the grid system that they use is 100 kilometres by 100 kilometres. It's far too wide for them to get any resolution of clouds and the effect of clouds. So they have to parameterize the effect. They have to sort of guess it. And that's what they've guessed. And we'll see what has happened so far. Now, this last climate change report, they had to widen the range to 1.5. So this figure of 2 has gone down to 1.5. So the range has widened rather than narrowed. So they spent billions of dollars on climate research, and instead of narrowing the range that we now can all agree with, they had to widen it. But every year, or every time they give their report, they say they're more confident. They started off with about 60% confidence, they're up to 90%, and it's now, this last one, they're 95% competent. But, I mean, it seems absurd. They're 95% competent, and they've had to widen the range in order to get it. That doesn't seem right to me. So, this is, here are the 90 climate change models. Here, this is the average of the models, which they claim is the reason they say that the average of these models is what we should use to assess the climate effect. The actual observed effect is here as two. The two figures, that's the lower troposphere, that's from satellites, and that is the Hadley Centre, the Climate Research Unit, and that's their figure. And both these figures of global temperature are in fact lower than almost every one of these models. So there's something gone wrong somewhere with the models. The models are wrong. Clearly wrong. This is a figure of from a Japanese meteorological agency. This shows our temperature rise over 100 years, from 1890 to 2010, but the trend is about 0.7 of a degree per century. So the planet is warming, and of course that warming gives us the sea level rise. If the planet was cooling, the sea level would fall. It's not, it's rising, but not very much, and it hasn't changed. It's virtually, it goes up and down a bit. There's a bit of cooling here in the 40s and 50s when we had storm surges and very cold weather, not only here but all over the world. And here it obviously it accelerated, and this is, they've got everybody excited with rise here. But this is now back down to this red line. So this is the current situation of warming. There's been no global warming for 18 years and 1 month. This is remote sensing satellite data, which is far more reliable than temperature gauges on the ground, which can be affected by urban heat island effects. This other line here is the rise of carbon dioxide, which of course continues to rise remorsefully, but there's no evidence that it's accelerating temperature. Well, this is the CO2. Up until about 1950, there was very little change, and then from 1950, it's really beginning to shoot up. So we are increasing the CO2 in the planet, no doubt about it. It's all ours. We did it. Otherwise, this would have probably continued in a straight line here. There's no doubt we are putting a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere, but is it affecting temperature? I think the planet is perfectly capable of looking after the small amount of CO2 we're putting in the planet, in my view. And as an example of that, this is the figure from 570 million years ago. About 500 million years ago, the CO2 content was 8,000 parts per million. We are down. No, wait a minute. That's just
try just pressing the control button on the computer.
No, I'm running out of
battery.
It would help if I turn the power on onto my computer, wouldn't it? Just flatten the battery.
Well, now I'm going to get
more attention here. Well, hopefully it will reappear fairly shortly. Well, the musical interlude now. Do you have any questions whilst this thing is powering up?
I thought it was that the Industrial Revolution affected anything. It just was a flat line, wasn't it? all those black chimneys, like the worst chimneys.
Yes, I mean, there is a slight outgassing from the oceans as the temperature increases. The temperature of the oceans have increased by about 0.7 degrees per century, and that would naturally increase the outgassing. So about 8% of the emissions of CO2, the rise of CO2, is due to outgassing from the oceans. Perhaps I should have checked that before. They don't look like a car, I think. Sometimes it can make a weird noise. But the trouble is, these old laptops, they have such poor battery life.
It might be that you need to reboot it.
Resuming windows, that's encouraging, isn't it? Well, we're hoping to get some modelling done of the storm surges, which will then give us the height that we're going to need to use to raise the walls. Getting that light is quite important.
Can't get cross a rail to let you have
some for waste oil.
Well, they're making new islands in the estuary of the Thames with the Cunnis bed.
Yes, I know. It's all going to... It's all going to Wallasey Island.
Yeah, we'll come to Sarah.
Well, indeed, it would be nice if we could. So, just finishing up on that, so there we are, 8,000 parts per million here, about 5 million years ago. Then this was the Carboniferous period coming down here, where plants and trees were evolved, and diatoms in the sea, and vast amounts of carbon.
So.
10,000 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere was almost taken to zero by the action of trees and plant growth and plankton in the sea. And that's during this period that the White Cliffs of Dover were laid down. 300 meters of chalk, vast chalk deposits all over the world. It rose again here, not quite sure why. Some of you might know. Went over there, and then this is 20 million years ago, and we're sort of down roughly to where we are at the moment. But we're probably going to end up about to this figure here. So it is going to shoot up, and that's entirely due to the use of fossil fuels by humans. Now. This is interesting. John, my friend over here, and I went sailing around the coast in 2013, and we ended up on the Isle of Lewis, and the stones of Cavendish we went to see. These were built 5,000 years ago, but they were abandoned 3,400 years ago. Now, at that time, this was a very prosperous area, with trees and cattle and barley and loads of people having a wonderful time. It was the time of the Holocene climate optimum, where it was very warm up in Lewis, and they had such a wonderful time and built a whole load of stones to celebrate it. If you go there now, it's the most godforsaken place the rain comes at you straight at you at 90 degrees, the wind and the cold is just absolutely bitter. The whole of this site was almost up to the top of these stones with moss peat, and that's about the only thing that grows there. And they've cleared all that now. This is Greenland ice cores. This is the known warm period, and after that, that's when they left the Lewis. It got very cold then. The Roman warm period, and here we are, the medieval warm period, the Little Ice Age, and we're here. In fact, we're a little bit higher than that, because that was 1950s, I think, when it was drafted. We're about here now. So the temperature is rising, but it's still not as warm as the medieval warm period, which is about 1,000 years ago. This bottom curve is from Hubert Lamb, who was one of the originators of the climate research unit in East Anglia. He produced this curve here, which was in fact used in the first IPCC report in 1990. This shows the medieval warm period, warmer than it is today, and the Little Ice Age, where it was very much colder. Interestingly, above here is a new curve which had been produced by Grinspeed, showing the sea level. So the sea level was 200 millimetres higher there, and then about 400 millimetres lower at this point here, during the Little Ice Age, indicating quite clearly that sea level does in fact follow the global temperature. So that's what we're seeing at the moment. It is rising. It's rising quite steeply, actually. This is another curve of the of 2,000 years of global temperature, again showing the medieval warm period here, where the Vikings arrived in Greenland, and it was called Greenland because it was green. And they had a whale of a time, but a few hundred years later, it got too cold for them and they had to leave. And then we come down to the Little Ice Age, where we had ice skating on the Thames in 1600 around, and we have been warming ever since. And the warming that we're seeing now is a purely natural cycle. But it's not the major player by any means. So this is my final slide. These are my conclusions. The government is spending £20 billion a year on subsidies on wind farms and solar farms. £500 billion they would have spent by 2050. This is a waste of money. It would be better spent on thorium and molten salt reactor research to provide a safe and cheap base power generation. We definitely shouldn't be burning coal in power stations. It's a finite resource, and eventually us humans must find a way of not using it, of finding something else. We need to generate electricity to power our world. And the only way we can do that, in my opinion, is by nuclear reactors. And there's some new ideas here of which you can look up on the internet, thorium and molten salt reactors. Very interesting new designs. The Chinese are going to be the first country in the world to have the very first thorium reactor, commercial thorium reactor, and that's coming on stream this year. They're going to be streets ahead of the world, and that is by far the best thing to be spending our money on. Not building these absurd windmills. They kill birds, they're very inefficient. When the wind stops, as it did only 10 days ago, we've spent £80 billion on windmills so far, and 10 days ago I looked at the output from these wind farms and it's only 0.26 of a gigawatt, which is only about 1% of what we need. And so far we've spent £80 billion of it. And for that we could have had 6 or 8 nuclear reactors, and we could be generating 30 gigawatts, and yet this money only produced 0.3 of a gigawatt. Now, not everybody agrees with nuclear for generation, but these new technologies of thorium and molten salt don't produce nearly as much radioactive material. Because the old reactors were basically to build bombs with plutonium, and that's what we're still using now. And we have to find something else which is safer. My other point is the benefit-cost ratio should be restored to 1-to-1 for the Environment Agency before more farms and villages fall into the sea and be lost for good. And the places that are going, as you probably know, Haysborough, Hemsby, Inco, Hythe, they're all falling into the sea. There's no protection of them to them at all. Whereas on the other side of the continent, the other side of the North Sea, they have got groins from Calais to Denmark. Every 200 metres, they've got 100 or 200 metre groin. And that is giving them fantastic beaches, and they have no erosion problems. The final one, stop wasting money on habitat creation. This really is absurd. £12 million a year. £540 million by 2050. That money could have rebuilt most of our East Coast districts. My last point was protect what we have for as long as we can until the evidence dictates otherwise.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Nine o'clock.
Spot on.
Have you considered tidal?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the tidal power, but it's very expensive. It doesn't actually produce a lot of energy. But my point is that if people can make money out of it, they should do it. But what we shouldn't be doing is subsidising these things because they're green. We don't need any subsidy. If they work and they are efficient, then people will be putting them in. But we are subsidising, which corrupts and distorts the market, in my opinion.
The trouble with tidal power is it's generally not easily controllable.
No.
There are one or two straits where you know where the water is going to be and how fast it's going to be flowing. And that's predictable and reliable, but most other places it just isn't.
Yeah. The other thing, we do need gas generation, because even with nuclear power, it's a fixed load, and if you look at the loading for Great Britain, you get a fixed load of about 30 gigawatts, and then it can shoot up to 60 gigawatts. So you need to be able to turn on fast, some fast generation, and that usually means that it has to be gas, which they can get up and running within an hour. But you can't do that with nuclear, and you certainly can't do that with wind farms or solar. At the night you've got nothing, and when the wind stops you have nothing.
I wonder how much electricity you would get from forest fires with dynamos on them.
We're not people, yes.
There are certainly a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, solar on houses is probably that probably is okay. I don't like them myself,
no.
But it's a perfectly reasonable idea putting solar power on houses. I think that's okay. But sticking windmills in the North Sea. The most extraordinary thing I found when I went down to on my sailing trip around Britain, I went to Weymouth and walked into the chandlery, happened to be talking about windmills. They said, "Ah, well, we have a guy in Weymouth Harbour whose sole job it is every day to take diesel out to the wind farms to keep the blades turning, because if they ever stop, the gearboxes seize up and it costs millions to replace them. So they've all got diesel generators in them to keep them turning.
Around at sea, we often see them, most of the stations.
Yeah. Well, they shouldn't be. I know some are stationary. It's not very good. If they're stationary for long, it's big trouble. I don't know whether they've solved that, and some of the older wind turbines were bad. But I agree, I've seen quite a number which are stationary. That is not good. But they probably the gearboxes have in fact seized. They're very expensive to repair. And of course we're building them, we're spending £20 billion a year building them, still are. And we're going to carry on doing that until 2050. Because this government has the Climate Change Act. The Climate Change Act commits the country to spending £500 billion over the next 35 years. There's nothing we can do about it until they repeal the Act. But the Act, the Climate Change Act, was signed up by all except six people. One of them was Peter Lilly, and I think the other one was that lovely lady, what's her name? There's only six that voted against it, so it's going to be very difficult to change it. Because we're fed continuously from the media and from the government that we're all doomed due to climate change, it's all our fault, and we just have to spend all this money on windmills to try and stop it, to stop a catastrophe for our grandchildren. But there's not a shred of evidence that this is true. To me, as a completely independent person, I looked for evidence and I found absolutely nothing which convinces me that that the planet cannot easily deal with the CO2 we've put into it. But that's not to say we should carry on burning fossil fuels. We should try desperately to find a way around it. But that's nothing to do with CO2. It's because these are precious resources and we shouldn't fritter them away generating electricity with them. We should do other things with them. There's plastics that can be used. We still need cars. And there's nothing really to replace diesel and petrol for a car. That doesn't use very much compared with the generation of electricity, which is like 3/4 of it. So it would last a long time if the power generation was done by nuclear, which is what I think we should be doing.
There's fracking as well, isn't there? I mean, that's
the government realised that with all this money being spent on windmills, that they need exactly the same amount of money spent on gas-fired generators to power the country when the wind stops. And you get a blocking high over Great Britain, and it just plummets the output from the wind farms, and you need gas-fired generation to cope. That's the only way you can get the power. Otherwise, all the lights would go off. It's getting close to it now. I bought my generator just in case.
How long could you survive?
Not long
enough.
Well, I've got enough power that would probably last me a week, but that's about all. I've got a wooden fire, not a lot of wood.
But you can have wood chipping, can't you? I've heard of wood chipping burners, you know.
Yes. Well, of course, they converted one of the Drax power stations to wood chips, and the wood chips have to come from California. There aren't enough wood chips in Europe to fire it. I'm not sure it's California, but it's from America. It's just madness.
Probably more energy in transporting and producing.
Exactly. And they couldn't. The other thing, of course, is biofuels. That's completely absurd, that is.
Yeah.
That's destroying the country. It's putting an awful lot of CO2 into the atmosphere. Not that that matters, but it does. It's completely the wrong thing. And that's, you might say, well, why are we doing all these things? I think it's, I'm afraid to say, it's an environmentalist takeover of the government. They certainly control almost the entire IPCC. It's stuffed full of environmental activists who are desperately trying to decarbonize the world and try and get us back to the subsistence state. But that's not really, it's not really going to do us any good. It's going to cause a lot of people a lot of grief, particularly in third world countries, where they're not being encouraged to put coal-fired power stations. They have nothing, and so they're going to be left with no power generation, and that's the only way they can build themselves up and advance, just like we did. We've done it from the back of coal, and it's now our responsibility to find a good, cheap, inexpensive, safe nuclear way forward for the world.
There was another fuss in the referendum in Scotland about North Sea oil. You remember, there was a big political issue, and so it'll just go along, we'll get lots of money, but,
Then
the money. It was the money, but I mean...
the price drop.
They were missing the wider point, weren't they? Might run out, but also, you have to look at other alternatives.
Well, one of the best things, of course, is hydro. Hydro is superb, that really is good.
Yeah.
And pumped hydro, where you have, if you've got excess power from your wind turbines, you can pump the water up into a big valley and use that as a stored source of energy. But you can't, there's no battery that's going to be able to store energy, because that thing would be horrendously dangerous, because you store a week or 2 weeks energy into a massive battery. Should you ever get a short circuit and you blow the city where it is to smithereens, the explosion would be absolutely earth shattering. Far better than this coal or oil or gas.
Storage is the problem, isn't it, really?
If you've got wind farms, you need to store it, but the only way to do that is to pump water uphill. But sadly, we've got very few hills in Scotland, we have, but not here.
It reminds me of that chap at Cragside, Lord Armstrong, a man ahead of his time, who used water to power all his electricity. You heard of the National Trust, and he's got a station, and he has a pump. And I mean, this, I don't know, 1900s or something, and he was, I think, one of the first houses to get electricity, and it was all water
power.
Yes,
powered. I saw that.
He seemed to have, forgotten about it.
Yeah,
well,
I've been there.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, these small things are fine, you can have a windmill in your garden, and you might generate a few hundred watts, but you can't run your house on it. Your fridge would need probably 10 times that amount.
This chap has electricity, all the roof, big house, and it's all from hydropower.
Yeah. Well, if you've got the continuous flow of water, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you certainly need that. But when the water dries up, all your lights go out.
Yeah.
Not something one would want.
Yeah.
Or if it froze, the stream is frozen, and all the lights go out in the middle of winter.
It's a very interesting subject, the climate.
I don't know what you think of it. Does anybody disagree with what I've said?
It would be very difficult to disagree, because Marvin, it's your source of information, which apparently just isn't there. Is that fair?
Well, it depends. If you look hard enough at a lot of the government sites, particularly the Royal Society, they published a booklet which debunks everything that I've said. You could get one of those, and then you could hit me over that next time you see me.
Yeah, they would, wouldn't they?
Well, of course, it's very sad, in my opinion, that such a prestigious society, the Royal Society, have accepted the science without question. Mm. Well, I call it science. You know, I don't know what it is. It's not good evidence that they have, because I don't believe there is sufficient evidence to show that the hypothesis that CO2 can be multiplied by a factor of 6 is right.
Yeah.
It's only a guess. And 25 years later, we still don't know. That's why the climate sensitivity range has actually got wider. Because the thing is, if you're a government and you've just spent £80 billion worth of taxpayers' money on windmills, you can't then turn around and say, oh, sorry guys, we got it all wrong, we made a mistake. But we'd say, we want our bloody money back. But we can't, it's all gone.
But spending the money on windmills is the answer to thousands of unemployed people.
Well, the thing is, if we had cheaper electricity, that would generate more money than spending it all on windmills. The windmills are all made in China. Almost none of it. The only thing we get is the installation and the service contracts.
Which is nothing. One area of Lowestoft,
Yes, there's probably 100 people in Lowestoft that make their money out of servicing windmills. But if we had nuclear power research, they could go and work on that, some of them. I don't know. I mean, I don't know all the answers.
Well, we haven't educated our children enough. You know, we need more engineers, scientists.
We do need more engineers. Yes.
Anyhow, I've got them. Sorry, I was just going to say, one of the things one hears is that a lot of electricity is lost in transmission.
Hmm.
And as you're an electrical engineer, it's always seemed to me that why wasn't any research money put into trying to reduce this? Is it an intractable problem?
No, they have significantly reduced transmission losses from these wind farms. But some of them are 50
kilometres. There
is a solution to that, and that is to use DC, direct current. If you use direct current, you can halve the losses. But this is very expensive to do, because you have to take alternating current made by the wind turbines, convert it to DC, which is vast amounts of electronics required to do that, very expensive stuff. And then when you get to the other end, you have to reconvert it from DC back to AC, with a similar vast cost to put it into the grid.
But forgetting about wind farms at the moment, just ordinary transmission electric.
You know, so you might lose 5%.
Oh, is that
over, yes, 5%, let's say, from Sizewell to wherever it goes into the grid in Ipswich or something. That's not a great deal. I mean, you can easily generate that with a nuclear reactor. A bit of extra, 5% extra, just heats the air a bit, warms the feet of the birds.
In Sicily, apparently, it doesn't matter that the windmills don't turn round because they're not actually connected to anything. That EU subsidies going to
matter. Well, yes, I mean, subsidies are not a good thing in my opinion. They corrupt the market. Subsidies may be fine for a short period of time, but they have to stand on their feet. The other thing about wind turbines, the people who run them, are getting paid 3 times the price of their electricity. Coal and gas, they're only allowed to charge about 5p per unit. The wind turbines are getting 15p per unit, and that probably won't change in their lifetime. So not only have they got this vast subsidy, they're getting 3 times the price for their electricity.
I don't know if it's changed very recently, but there was this so-called feed-in tariff.
For solar?
And wind.
Yes.
And other generation, whereby you could generate electricity by one of these methods, and whatever was recorded as coming out of your generator required a feed-in tariff in proportion to the amount of electricity produced. It doesn't matter if you just stuck a steel rod into the ground and fed it all into the ground, as long as it came out of the generator, mm-hmm. it was there, and he got paid for it. Of course, there was extra connected to the grid.
Now, there's a lot of corruption in this this CO2 malarkey. I mean, there's the all the carbon credits. Billions of pounds are being made fogging those to the detriment of the general public, because we're all paying for it in our electricity bills. And we will be for the next 30, 40, 50 years until somebody puts a stop to the madness.
One needs behaviour. This is a UK thing. We can go around the world, don't see many turbines.
Well,
is it, is it us? Is it because we're windy and you think we'll do a big
explosion? Well, I think we are very windy. But I think we are the only country with a Climate Change Act which has committed the government to spending continuously this amount of money. And there's nothing that can stop it except repealing the Act. That's an extremely difficult thing to do. And I think there's no stopping it. We're just going to, year after year after year, we're going to be watching the £20 billion a year being wasted in these windmills. And the people that that are putting them up, they're all going to be gone. They're not going to be hanging around for many years. Because they only have a life of about 15 to 20 years. And they're not going to do anything. They're just going to hand them over to the government and say, oh, sorry, we've gone bust. You'll have to look after them. And so the government is going to be saddled with thousands and thousands of windmills in the North Sea and around the coast, which are failing. And they don't know, and they won't know what to do with them. It'll be one of the big disasters for our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have to pay for it, and they'll see when it is shown that the IPCC have got their figures wrong, they'll say, how on earth did you allow mm-hmm. this to happen? I think it's probably one of the biggest, it's a worldwide problem, because many countries have signed up to this scheme of renewable energies which just don't work. And they're going to cost us dear. And the people that are going to be, it's going to cost dear, not the likes of me and perhaps you here, it's going to be the poorer people of this country. And the poorer people of the world, in third world countries, they're the ones that are going to suffer. In my opinion. As I say, I've left one or two things out there if anybody wants to have a look at them.
Meanwhile, thank you very, very much indeed. That has been absorbing and many-sided, and has certainly reinforced my view of what apparently goes on. Thank you very much indeed.